You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. I want to tell you about a great new podcast called Outside the Box. If you're a maker, an innovator, or even just a consumer who wants to peek behind the curtain of some of the world's greatest organizations, you'll love it. The latest episode features interviews with the visionaries who are creating systems that bring our work, and more importantly, our workforce, into the 21st century. Because although we're plugged in at home, when it comes to the workforce, we're lagging behind. Listen to Outside the Box in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. As you probably know by now, I'm a big reader. I'm also known for sharing good books with friends and family, and the one book I've given to more people than any other is a short, easy-to-read little tome packed with lots of life wisdom called Happiness is a Serious Problem. I've been wanting to have the author, Dennis Prager, on the podcast ever since I started this show, and today Dennis and I will sit down for a wide-ranging conversation covering everything from politics and religion to relationships, suffering, and of course, happiness. Dennis Prager is one of America's most respected talk show hosts. He's been broadcasting on the radio since 1982, and his highly popular program, The Dennis Prager Show, airs live Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to noon Pacific and noon to 3 Eastern out of his home station at KRLA in Los Angeles. He's frequently appeared on C-SPAN as well as Larry King Live, The Early Show on CBS, The Today Show, The O'Reilly Factor, Hardball, Hannity, and The Dennis Miller Show. Dennis Prager has also written 7 books, including the aforementioned bestseller Happiness is a Serious Problem, as well as Still the Best Hope, Why the World Needs American Values to Triumph, Think a Second Time, Why the Jews, The Reasons for Anti-Semitism, and The 9 Questions People Ask About Judaism, which is still the most used introduction to Judaism in the world. His writings have also appeared in major publications such as Commentary, The Weekly Standard, The Wall Street Journal, and The Los Angeles Times. In 2009, Prager started his educational website, Prager University, which offers 5-minute videos on various subjects such as the 10 Commandments, the minimum wage, the Middle East, global warming, and happiness, of course. And to date, PragerU has received over 500 million views. Dennis Prager also periodically conducts orchestras and has introduced hundreds of thousands of people to classical music, and yet somehow even that seems to cause controversy for him. Today, Dennis Prager will talk about the politicization of his recent symphony concert at Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles. He'll caution that the war on opioid addiction may have unintended consequences and explain why he says the media is a greater threat to America than Vladimir Putin. Dennis Prager also warns that America may be in the middle of what he calls a second civil war, and it's not the kind of civil war that you're thinking of after Charlottesville. In fact, I should point out that this conversation was recorded before the violence in Charlottesville, so that's why you won't hear anything on that subject in this interview, but you will hear Dennis discuss why he says if he had his choice, he'd spend all of his time talking about what he refers to as the really big issues instead of politics, why he spends so much time thinking about human suffering in the world, and then Dennis Prager talks about his philosophy of happiness and why he believes it's not just a feeling, but a moral obligation. Plus, we talk about his love of a good cigar, the time he shared a stogie with the great George Burns, and why his vocabulary sometimes gets a little salty in that notorious L.A. traffic. Coming up with Dennis Prager in just a moment. Dennis Prager is a popular nationally syndicated radio host, a best-selling author, and a syndicated columnist who's regularly published on townhall.com, National Review, and the Jewish World Review, as well as the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, and Commentary, just to name a few. He's also the founder of Prager University, an online educational organization that produces free short videos on subjects important to the understanding of American values. Mr. Prager, thanks for having me over for a talk.
Pleasure. Welcome to my home.
Happy to be here, and happy birthday, or happy belated birthday.
Yeah. Well, you're early by 360 days. That's another way to look at it.
Okay.
So either way, thank you.
Now, are you one of those guys who thinks it's silly for adults to celebrate birthdays, or do you throw a party? Do you do some reflecting? How do you acknowledge the day?
I'm a big believer in the importance of birthdays, actually. But I'm not a party fan, so they're two separate issues. And I do attach significance, and people should call you up or send you a text or a card. I think it's a nice thing to do. It's your day, one out of 365 days. So I've always thought it significant, but I've never wanted a birthday party. This was a real exception, and it was an exception. Okay, forgive the fact I do have dogs here.
What are the dogs' names?
Otto, Snoopy, and Peanut.
And you have a bulldog. You have
a
Basset Hound. Yeah,
and a
and little I don't know
guy.
What Peanut
he's
is.
He's a mix. I don't know what he is either. We inherited him because his father unfortunately died. His father is the father of my stepsons, and he killed himself. He shot himself. About half a year ago, I wrote a whole column on that. Why my stepson's father committed suicide. And I'm mentioning it because I'm quite angry about the situation. In our understandable upsetness over opioid addiction, we have made it almost impossible for vast numbers of people with horrific pain to get pain relievers. This man had fallen off a ladder, done great damage to his abdomen, and the horrific pains that he had internally could have been relieved, but doctors in California were too afraid to prescribe drugs that kill pain because of our war against addiction. So what we've done is we've done nothing about addiction or little about addiction, and we've caused innumerable people intense suffering, which could be relieved. And that's the only reason he killed himself. He loved life. And I'm really angry. And you people don't know this. They unless they're in the situation, they don't know how many people are deprived of painkillers, which is almost sadistic. But anyway, that's back to the reason. That's why we have the third dog.
I know that Chris Christie is hoping that the president will take his recommendations on opioid addiction.
I don't know what Chris Christie's recommendations have been. It's hard to know if there is a federal or even state answer to the problem, because the harder you make it to get opioids, the more people who need them.
Right.
It's not like cocaine. You know, that should just be banned. But opioids have a moral necessity to them. It's a very complex issue.
Well, you've never shied away from complex issues.
I don't shy away from anything.
You have grappled, I think, with some of the most fundamental questions of human existence throughout your career, like why does evil exist? Why are we here? How could a just God allow the Holocaust to happen? Is there one particular question that gnaws at you the most?
I've always been troubled by the amount of unjust suffering on Earth. this is, it never leaves me. When you read about World War II and the aftermath, what people have gone through in vast numbers, if you're sensitive to it, it never leaves you. And it bothered me when I was a kid in high school, and it bothers me as much today.
I think it was your first book was Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism, and you later wrote a book about anti-Semitism. As a Jew and as someone who has faith, how do you reconcile that when you look back at the Holocaust and all the suffering?
God allows human beings to choose to do evil. And as soon as that allowance was made, evil ensued. So what? The only choice was for God to create a creature that couldn't do evil. And the only creatures that can't do evil, I guess animals can't, because they don't have a knowledge of good and evil. Whales play with seals in a sadistic way, but they don't do it out of free will. But ultimately, we would have to be sort of like flowers or trees or robots. But my answer is ultimately, this is what God created, and I spend my life trying to influence people to take the God who demands moral behavior seriously, the God of the Ten Commandments. And I don't know of any other possible solution to the problem of evil than ethical monotheism, the belief in the God who demands ethical behavior and who judges us accordingly. This country, the USA, was founded by ethical monotheists. They were Christian in a general sense. Most were not Christian in a theological sense. But every one of them believed in a God who judges and intervenes.
You mentioned your upbringing in liberal Jewish New York. I know that you were raised fairly conservative religiously. Were they also politically conservative, your parents?
No. They weren't leftists. They were liberals. They were classic liberals. Liberal meant open-minded.
Yeah.
The campus is now run by the left. There was no open-mindedness. There are people who were trying to stop me from conducting at the Walt Disney Music Hall because Music Center. Because I'm conservative. It's really astonishing that, in fact, the New York Times is now on this story, that we've gone from banning speakers who might speak conservative ideas to banning a musician who will not even speak. I wave my baton. Because, you know, it's an avocation of mine, conducting. I'm a very serious musician. But it's really a phenomenon. They are that frighteningly closed-minded on the left.
You're supposed to conduct Haydn at Walt Disney Hall, actually. What is it, August 6th?
August 16th.
And there were, what, two or three musicians who said that they wouldn't play, and then they said that they didn't want you to conduct at all, even if they weren't there.
One of them, needless to say, the letter was written by three or four people, and two of them were professors at UCLA. I'm having one on my radio show. One won't come on.
Oh, are you really?
Oh, yeah. I love to have people who have contempt for me on my show.
So they're going to make their argument for why you shouldn't be allowed to play music.
Right. Huh? Why I should not be allowed to conduct and why I'm a bigot. This is what I always like to hear. I want the evidence that I am a hate-filled bigot. And I mean, they wrote it out. I believe, I as a religious person, I believe that the marriage that the definition of marriage should have remained a man and a woman. You could say I'm wrong. That's perfectly legit. But why? If that's hate-filled bigotry, then Barack Obama was a hate-filled bigot till 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. And Hillary.
Yes.
Yeah.
But they saw the polls and they changed their mind.
You know, going to a liberal college like Columbia, I think you went there for your master's degree and left before you've completed your master's degree.
Yeah, it's an interesting story.
And you wrote a book instead.
Yes.
Is that a bit of a rebellion against the liberal institution?
No, it wasn't, actually. No. I'll tell you what it was. There's both a really noble and a really pathetic reason why I didn't finish my master's degree. I gave my master's thesis. I was in the Russia Institute at Columbia at the School of International Affairs. My instructor, the man who supervised my thesis, was Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was the head of the Russian Institute at the time, and he was the big communist affairs guy, and that was my field, mm-hmm. communist affairs. And I gave my thesis orally, but I don't touch type. And I didn't have it in me to then type out on page after page, and then with an error, rub it out with, you know, erasable white out, whatever it was. And I thought, if I'm going to spend that amount of time typing, I'd rather type something that will actually be read. I decided to write a book explaining Judaism. It became the best-selling English language introduction to Judaism. And I wrote that at 25 years of age. Right. And it's still in print.
Yeah, it was called The Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism.
Yep.
Now, it wasn't really geared toward practicing Jews, but to non-practicing Jews, even non-Jews and atheists, right?
It was geared to non-Jews, mm-hmm. atheists, to Jews who were secular, Jews who were not Orthodox. I'm not Orthodox, but I believe I'm not orthoprax, I'm Orthodox, which means I don't practice as much as Orthodox Jews do, but I do have Orthodox beliefs that God gave that God is the ultimate writer of the Torah. That's my belief. I'm writing a 500,000-word commentary on the Torah to make my case. That's the biggest project of my life. Exodus will be out in April. The first book will be Exodus, interestingly.
Now, in reaching out to non-practicing Jews, non-Jews, even atheists, that kind of goes against my idea of Judaism when I think of, you know, the rule where the rabbi is supposed to turn you away three times before he'll talk to you about converting.
Well,
do you feel that the religion should reach out more?
Well, there are two separate issues. It is not incumbent upon Jews and never has been to bring people to Judaism. Mm-hmm. Judaism doesn't care what your religion is. It cares if you're a good person. Mm-hmm. God judges everyone, Jew and non-Jew, by their deeds. That's the Jewish belief. I think it's a very noble and terrific belief. That's ethical monotheism. Now, what has happened is many Jews have gone overboard, some Orthodox Jews, and discouraged people from becoming Jewish, which mm-hmm. I think is wrong. People should be encouraged if they want to be, but I'm not trying to convert people to Judaism. I'm trying to convert people to ethical monotheism. If they're an ethical monotheist, as an evangelical, as a Catholic, as a Mormon, as just an ethical monotheist, I am just as happy. The number of people who call my show or write me to tell me they went back to church after listening to my arguments for God and religion is very heartening to me. Mm-hmm. I've probably brought more people back to church than almost any living pastor, and more people to synagogue than almost any living Jew. It's a very interesting life I've led. I'm very proud of that. I have no compunction about saying it, and it gives me a great deal of comfort.
It's interesting how important your religious views are to you, and yet you're able to work with someone like Adam Carolla on this new project that you have, this documentary about political correctness in universities. Here you are, a Jewish conservative. He's an atheist libertarian. How did a project like that come together?
Adam Carolla and I share virtually every value.
Really?
We're not theologically the same, but we are morally almost identical. See, my belief is, aside from all the other aspects of conservatism is common sense. The further left you go, the more you abandon common sense. You enter the realm of suspension of common sense, and you enter the realm of faith, but truly far more irrational faith than any religious person I know. I mean, to believe that there's no such thing as male and female, I don't knock the idea that there are some people with gender dysphoria, people who are cursed, and I say it in a totally sympathetic way. It's like, you know, being cursed with some other debilitating thing. To believe that you are not the sex that your body is, I mean, you have two X chromosomes, you have a vagina, you have a uterus, you produce eggs, you have breasts, and you produce milk, but you're a man.
It's a disconnect with reality.
Well, all right. Yes. Now, that doesn't mean, though, if you undergo surgery and you look like a man and talk like a man, I will recognize you. Yes, that's fine.
Interesting.
Yes, absolutely. My problem is with those who maintain the physiological aspects of the sex they're born and still want to be referred to as the other sex. That's not fair to society. You're asking us to enter a disconnect that is not rational. But if you undergo the surgery and you look like, talk like, and act like the other sex, I'm not going to give you a hard time. In fact, there would be no reason for me to, because I wouldn't know it. Isn't that the point?
Yeah.
There are beautiful transgendered women out there. Whether they're beautiful or not, they're women, and if they have become a woman, I will refer to them in that way. But we're having something far worse now. We have males who identify as women who compete against other women in sports, and then they just defeat them in mixed martial arts, right? In MMA boxing or fighting, they're one of the strongest women alive, one of the strongest women fighters, was given a concussion in under 3 minutes. She said she had never met a woman with such strength, that, of course, because it was a man who identifies as a woman.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
It does seem a little unfair.
It's completely unfair. And it's happening in weightlifting. It is happening in track. And these are the compassion people. What about the compassion for all the women who want to compete with other women?
A few years ago, you started this nonprofit online educational group called Prager University, which produces free short videos on subjects important to the understanding of American values, as it's described on the site. Was this born out of your fight against political correctness?
It was born in large measure out of my fight worse than political correctness. We are seeing the moral upheaval in Western society. One of the most obvious examples is, for the first time in American history, I would say at least half of American college students have a negative view of America. This has never happened. This is another victory for the left in its moral sickness. Like when I asked Howard Zinn, the most famous left-wing historian, I had him on my radio show and asked him, does he think that it was a good thing that America was created? And he did not think so. So Prager University was created to give over the truth, number one, moral clarity, number two, and it has succeeded to an extent that I can't even say I dreamt. I dreamt for a million views a year. This year we will have 500 million views.
Wow, that is stunning.
It is stunning. We're the largest maker of non-entertainment videos, I think, in the world. Yes, because the animal one that beats us is entertainment, I think. Yeah. No.
I think that might be questionable whether it's
right. Okay. Well, some find it entertaining. I'm sure I would. But we are changing minds. That's the thing. There are many great conservative sites. Believe me, I love them. I work with them. But very few change minds, and very few change minds in large numbers. The biggest single age group watching Prager University videos is under 35 years of age.
Yeah, I think that's what I've always appreciated about you as a radio host and what you're doing with Prager University is that, unlike other conservative talk radio hosts, you're not just regurgitating talking points all the time and going back to the same political position. You speak about a lot of broader issues, which goes back to everything from religion and monotheism to good versus evil, male-female relationships, and happiness, things like that. Is that the key to luring people in and actually changing people's minds?
It's one
key. About something more relevant to their lives?
Yes, perhaps? Well, relevance is a big factor, but it is one key. It's not the only. We give some of the finest minds through an extremely elaborate process of editing and editing and editing what they say, every one of whom, and these are Pulitzer Prize winners,
every one of whom. Paul Johnson.
Well, Paul Johnson.
Great historian.
Yeah, he's not a Pulitzer Prize winner because he's a Brit, but he's arguably the greatest living historian.
Mm-hmm. And I agree.
We've had Paul Johnson. I mean, Charles Krauthammer has given a course, and George Will's given a few courses, and Alan Dershowitz, believe it or not, has given a few courses. If you have something important to say, we want you to say it. Mm-hmm. But my point is, we edit everything they say, not mm-hmm. because they're not terrific, but because they are writing, when they submit their 750 words, mm-hmm. which is essentially 5 minutes, 750 words, when they submit it, they are really submitting a column. But if we had them read a column, people would fall asleep.
Yeah.
It has to be written in a way and delivered in a way that will keep people's interest mm-hmm. and make one or two points. And that's successful. Plus, they're very, very professionally illustrated. Top people getting top money. Every one of these videos costs a fortune to make, but we have people who donate. It's a tax-exempt organization. We need people to help us. They do help us. We need more, because the more we have, the more we'll market. My dream, this I do dream, I want to influence the whole world. There's no reason with the internet why you can't.
Yeah.
See, here is a very major belief of mine. If an idea is good, it's good for everybody, not just Americans or not just Christians. When I started teaching Torah, only Jews took my class because it was given at a Jewish seminary, and it was the Torah after all. But gradually word got out to non-Jews that it's irrelevant if you're a Jew, because Prager doesn't think that it only speaks to Jews. As I said in every opening year session, I would say, I am teaching everybody of every background, atheists, Christians, everyone. Because either the Torah has something to say to everyone, or it has nothing to say to the Jews. Mm-hmm. The idea that it only has something to say to Jews is as absurd as saying vitamin C is only good for Presbyterians. That's the way I would put it every time.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Dennis Prager when we come back in just a moment. Hey guys, do you hate shopping for clothes? Well, now there's an easier way to get better clothes, Bombfell. Bombfell is an online personal styling service that helps men find the right clothes for them. And unlike other services, there are no fees to work with them, so it costs nothing to sign up. It's simple and straightforward. All you have to do is complete a questionnaire, and a dedicated personal stylist will handpick pieces specially for you. Then, once you've viewed your selections, you'll have 48 hours to make any changes or even cancel altogether. You're in total control, and you only pay for the clothes you keep. Plus, you have the option of receiving clothes once every 1, 2, or 3 months, because Bombfell is on your side, and they don't make money if you don't find something you want to keep. I just got my first order from Bombfell. I gave my stylist my measurements and answered just a few questions about my style and what I like. He came back to me with a hand-picked outfit just for me. My stylist selected a beautiful sports jacket made out of high-quality linen, perfect for the summer, along with a button-down and a polo shirt that go great with my new jacket or on their own. I was able to change the color if I want, and if I'm ever not in love with the selection, I just say so, and my stylist comes back to me with a totally new selection. And these weren't some weird off-brand items. We're talking quality, fashionable clothes that fits great. Plus, it was easy and fast, and I didn't have to waste a lot of time in a store. I love good clothes, and that's why I really love Bombfell. Best of all, I've negotiated with Bombfell to get my listeners a special offer of $25 off your first purchase when you go to bombfell.com/kick. That's Bombfell, spelled BOMBFELL.com/kick. And now, back to the show. You also lectured on Russian affairs when you were in grad school at Columbia.
I'd be interested, given your background on Russian affairs, to hear your take on the Russia hacks and more broadly on Putin and the U.S.-Russia relationship.
Just 5 years ago, Barack Obama poo-pooed the Republican standard bearer, Mitt Romney, when he said that Russia was our number one geopolitical enemy.
Right.
The whole left laughed at him. But now that it's all of a sudden in their interest, see, the left doesn't ask what's true. It's not the animating question. In the Russia thing, it's not what is true. Mm-hmm. It's what will benefit us in seeking power.
I'd like to know what's true.
I'd like to get
some kind of result from all
I don't know what's true.
Yeah.
Why isn't it a headline? I have no idea what they did.
Okay.
Neither do you, and neither do the Democrats.
But do you believe that they did hack the election?
No, I don't know.
Regardless of collusion or no collusion.
I do not know.
Really?
I do not know.
Okay.
And the reason I do not know is that the DNC won't give its computer over to the FBI.
Oh, interesting.
And they've been asked to.
Interesting.
They've refused. Why is that not headline every single day? This is day number 207 in the refusal of the Democratic Party to hand its computer to the FBI.
Yeah, and you recently tweeted that the news media in the West, you felt, pose a far greater danger to Western civilization than Russia does. What did you mean by that?
Well, I wrote what I meant by it in my next column. Oops. But I stand by it. The only thing I wrote in my next column, I wrote, I regret one thing. I should have said the universities. Western universities and Western media. I should have included universities. Putin is not teaching American youth to prefer socialism to capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know that now at least half of American college students think that socialism is preferable to capitalism. Has Putin done that? Has Putin voted to remove American flags, caused American flags to be removed from campuses? Has Putin caused the University of Pennsylvania English Department to remove the poster of Shakespeare because he's a white male?
Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
I know, and it's a scandal that it's not better known. It is, yes. He's a dead white, he's a Dwem, a dead white European male. The fact that he's the greatest player, they don't even believe that. New York Times had a piece last week. President was wrong. The chief of, I'm deeply involved in classical music, as we mentioned.
Right.
So I read all this stuff. When the president said, you know, Western civilization, you know, among our great achievements is the symphony. And so the head of the leading music critic of the New York Times, right, why is the symphony any better than Indonesian gamelan music? Now, I happen to love world music.
Yeah.
I love music, really, from almost every society, but I was not familiar with Indonesian gamelan music. So since the New York Times chief music critic said, well, you know, no, Beethoven's Third is not superior to Indonesian gamelan music. I decided to look up gamelan music on YouTube.
Yeah, how'd you like it?
Well, I played it on the air, and I let people judge for themselves. Now, obviously, our ears are not attuned to this. The only thing I could say, I don't mock gamelan music. If it emotionally moves Indonesians, it's terrific. And I mean that sincerely. That's the purpose of music in many ways, to emotionally move you. But nobody outside of Indonesia plays gamelan music. But everybody on earth who has access plays Beethoven's Third. Because it is the greatest music ever written. The only point I'm making is that Western, you asked me about Putin.
Yeah.
Putin is not undoing Western civilization. Putin has not told Western Europe, bring in tens of millions of people who don't share your values. Mm-hmm. I've written books that I wish everyone would read, and I'm going to recommend the book of another author.
Okay.
And that is Douglas Murray and the book, The Strange Death of Europe. The man is an atheist, and he's gay. So he has all the qualifications that the left would love. And he writes about the suicide of the West. And it has nothing to do with Putin. But it has everything to do with the media and the universities.
Do you feel like Romney did, that he is our geopolitical foe, or Russia is?
Yeah, I don't think it's the greatest foe. I don't think, I'm not as scared of Russia as I am of North Korea or Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is the greatest foe on earth today. Russia has not vowed to annihilate another country.
Right.
And it is, but that means nothing to the left. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Who were keen on the Iran deal. So it's like it doesn't matter that another Holocaust is promised by the leaders of Iran, the greatest supporters of terror on earth. Now you could say, well, and the Russians are helping Iran. I agree with you.
True.
I think the guy is disgusting. But you didn't ask me, do I think he's disgusting? You asked me, do I think that he is the reason for the unraveling of Western civilization? And he's not.
Well, speaking of disgusting, prior to the election, you were fairly opposed to Trump on, I think,
not
moral
fairly.
Grounds.
Not fairly.
Aggressively.
Aggressively.
And you eventually came around to him once he was the nominee.
Which I said I would. In my first article in National Review condemning him, I said, but if he gets the nomination, I will support him.
How did you, once he got the nomination, how did you rationalize that as someone who had opposed him up to that point?
The way I did it while I opposed him.
Mm-hmm.
Anything is better than a Democrat. No, it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
The left is the enemy of this country. I'm sorry. Not liberals. Did I say it enough times? Not liberals. The left is destroying Western civilization. There was no Republican destroying Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
The left is. It is undoing the American Revolution. They believe in unlimited government. They believe in open borders, which means they don't even believe that America needs to be America.
Yeah, I mean, you've called it, in fact, I think a second civil war, right?
It is a second civil war.
If
exactly.
The first one was about slavery or states' rights, depending on who you ask, what would be the fundamental underpinning of this second civil war?
Is America and its founding ideals worth surviving? Mm-hmm. Are they worth surviving or not?
Mm-hmm.
The left does not believe so. They believe in an America that is Norway between Canada and Mexico.
Well, on a lighter note, I'm also a huge fan of your book, Happiness is a Serious Problem. I've actually given it to many friends, probably at least a dozen friends over the years.
I owe you
going
money.
Through divorces and all kinds of hardships. And I haven't had anyone say that they didn't get something out of it. I like that you say that happiness is not a feeling or necessarily a state of being, but it is an act and even a moral obligation. You explain it better than I ever could. So what is your philosophy of happiness?
For those of your listeners who don't know, I have a national radio show. I'm probably on in their city. And every Friday since 1999, I have devoted an hour to happiness. It does not matter what is happening in the world. I have never once, even after 9/11, I broadcast the Happiness Hour. And that is because, as I say in the introduction to that hour every week, the happy make the world better and the unhappy make it worse. I am on a crusade against unhappy people. I'm not talking about people in North Korea. They have a total right to be unhappy. I'm talking about people who inflict their bad moods on others. It's leftism in part is a psychological response to misery. Everyone has misery. One of the questions you have to grapple with in life, if you're an American, is America the source of my misery or is life the source of my misery and my own nature? Conservatives blame their own nature and life. The left blames America for their unhappiness.
Yeah, and one of the things that I like about that book is that you acknowledge that suffering is a part of life, and if you go through life expecting that you're not going to suffer, and that's the key to happiness, you're inevitably going to be disappointed. Is this acceptance of suffering and this determination to seek happiness in spite of it something that comes to you innately when you come from a people who've suffered for 3,000 years?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer, because most Jews are on the left. So they have a different attitude, I think. So I don't know if it's because I'm a Jew. I'm very much in touch with all that suffering and wrote a book on anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was I gave one lecture on happiness at UCLA. For about 30 years, people have subscribed to my lectures. They just get them periodically, first on cassette tape and now download. So I gave one talk on happiness. I was sure it was the only talk on happiness I'll ever give. And people got it. I then got a call about a year later from the women's magazine Red Book. The woman tracked me down. This is pre-internet. It was hard to find people. But she tracked me down. She was the articles editor for Red Book magazine. So she said, "Is this Dennis Prager?" I said, "Yes, this is so-and-so, articles editor at Red Book magazine." And I remember thinking, "I think you have the wrong Dennis Prager. Why would the articles editor of Red Book magazine be calling me? She want an article on ethical monotheism?" So she said, "I'd like you to write an article on happiness." So I'm so not, I so don't know how to push myself. I remember saying, "Why?" I didn't understand why she was calling me for an article on happiness. So I said, "Why?" And so then she said, "I'll tell you why. I heard your lecture on happiness." I said, and I'll never forget what I then said. I said, "Really? You subscribe to my lectures?" She said, "Are you kidding? I never heard of you. I didn't even know you produce lectures. All I know is you were on New York radio one night, and I stayed in my car the whole lecture till I found out who gave it." I said, "Wow. My whole talk was on New York radio?" She said, "You didn't know?" Sure enough, I don't know if it's in business anywhere, WEVD, this station which broadcast in Yiddish and in Korean and in Chinese. And anyway, totally, totally illegally.
I was going to say, did you get a commission off this?
Commission. I didn't know what happened. It was completely illegal. I could have sued them for a fortune, but these people changed my life. These crooks made much of my life possible. So she said, "It was so good, I had to find out who you are. So would you write an article?" I said, "Okay, I'll be happy to." So I wrote the article. They published it. Then I get a call from Random House. "Has a great article. We'd like you to write a book." And again, I said, "Book? I'm lucky I had an article in me." They said, no, sir, these are great ideas. Anyway, to make a very long story short, which was I've already made it too long, what happened was, in answer to your original question, I had so worked out for my life a systematic way of being happy, despite tragedy and sadness, that since I'm no different from any other human, what worked for me works for others. Mm-hmm. So I merely had to put in print what worked for me. And now, you know, I'm a source of happiness for a lot of people because of the Happiness Hour, the happiness lectures, right, and the book.
Yeah, it's kind of turned into its own little industry.
It truly is. Yes, it's the best-selling book I ever wrote.
I was just going to ask if that's your most popular book.
Oh, by far, yeah.
Well, one of the things that brings you happiness is a good cigar. In fact, if people are wondering what the hissing sound and the puffing sound was, I'm having a cigar with you right now.
Yep.
In your den, which is something out of a Victorian gentleman's club, I think.
This correct.
Is perfect setting for it.
Yes.
I have to ask about Cuba policy then. When it comes to Cuba, which takes precedent, the cigar aficionado in you or the champion of democracy and human rights?
Well, here's the amazing answer. I don't like Cuban cigars.
Really?
I beg people to give me Nicaraguan, Honduran, and Dominican. And it has nothing to do with the fact that they're communist. Nicaragua's communist. Mm-hmm. And they make, they and Dominican, and well, they all three make great. I don't care. I don't like the taste of Cuban cigars.
Really?
Yep. I overwhelmingly, I smoke 100% I smoke those other three countries.
Yeah.
And most of the time it's Nicaragua. Partially because I love a very strong cigar, and that Nicaragua produces. Dominican Republic tends to produce milder cigars, but they're also fine.
Well, I've also heard a lot of cigar aficionados say that they don't smoke Cubans anymore because the fields have gone fallow and they don't actually produce very good cigars anymore, like they used to.
Well, I don't know why they don't, and I'm not saying they don't. There are people who may like it. I don't like the taste of Cuban cigars. I just don't. They're bitter to me, and they're not yummy. I know it sounds odd to somebody looking at a cigar who never smoked one to think of the word yummy, but they are yummy. Otherwise, I wouldn't smoke them.
Well, I read once that you smoked a cigar with George Burns. What was George Burns like?
You know, that's interesting. So what happened was A man called me, said, I'm George Burns' accountant. George Burns loves your radio show.
Really?
And he'd like to meet you. And then I thought, okay, it's one thing not to pursue celebrities, but it's another to say no to a legend.
Yeah.
I am going to go to George Burns' house just to tell my mother I did. Who did, by the way, go crazy, I admit. My mother did seek out celebrities.
Any Jewish mom would eat that up.
Oh,
I'm sure.
I got to say, in this case, ethnicity doesn't play any role. Yeah. I think mothers, George Burns of that generation, that was, the guy's a legend. Mm-hmm. He was in his late 80s, maybe 90 even. And sure enough, he had three cigars and a couple of martinis, and I fell in. It was great. I fell in like a straight man, and I said, you know, George was curious, what does your doctor say about all the smoking and drinking? And he said, well, Dennis, my doctor is dead. And that was one of the great lines I was ever told. I love being with him. He spoke much of the time about his love for Gracie, his mm-hmm. wife. And I'm very interested in male-female relations. I have a male-female hour, just like I have a happiness hour. And listening to him lovingly talk about his wife and their marriage, she had died years earlier, telling me he still sleeps on the same side of the bed, you know, tells her things before he falls asleep. That was very moving to me.
Yeah, how long were they married? I mean, that was one of the great love
stories.
It was
one of the great love stories. Yes, it was. And I asked him how they met and stuff, and I always love hearing those stories. I am as interested in the micro as in the macro. That mm-hmm. is atypical of talk show hosts. The thought of talking politics 15 hours a week is, to me, nightmarish. If I had my druthers, I wouldn't talk about it almost at all. My first urge is the big issues. Mm-hmm. And that's the third dedicated hour I have. Once a week, I have an hour called the Ultimate Issues Hour. Yeah. It's about the big issues.
Yeah, people, not just politics, but life, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And of course, God, which is the ultimate issue.
Well, I've used up more of your time than I intended to this evening. You've been such a gracious host.
Well, you're a good interviewer. Thank you.
Before we wrap up, then, I just have to tell you one of the most amusing things I ever heard you say is I was in a group when you were speaking a few years ago, and I heard you say that you're a big believer in the judicious use of swear words.
Right.
At the risk of sounding like James Lipton, do you have a favorite swear word? Or you could give me the first
decline. No, the truth is I don't have a favorite one. Okay. But I rarely do use it, the truth is, but if there is a time I am most likely to use it, it is when a driver is going slowly in the left lane.
Yeah.
People always remark on how calm and cool I am, which I am. But they don't see me in the car when there are slow drivers in the left lane. I really let them have it. I mean, you know, the windows are closed. They don't hear me. Although I do fantasize having a police bullhorn and saying to them what I think. What the hell is wrong with you? Do you not understand this is for passing? But okay, don't get me started on that.
Well, folks, if you ever are on the 101 and there's some guy tailgating you, it may be Dennis Prager.
That's right. Prager. It may be. If you're going slowly in the left lane, it may be me.
All right. There you have it. Mr. Prager, thanks so much for taking time to talk to me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Many thanks again to Dennis Prager and his lovely wife, Susan, for having me over to his man cave for a good cigar and a good conversation. Dennis was also kind enough to invite us to his classical concert last night, and in spite of those who tried to politicize the event, I'm happy to report that Walt Disney Hall was packed to the brim with fans. He didn't even mention politics once, and it turns out the guy can really conduct an orchestra. So thanks, Dennis, for a terrific night of music. His nationally syndicated radio show, The Dennis Prager Show, airs weekdays from 9 to noon on the West Coast and from noon to 3 p.m. on the East Coast. To find your local station and learn more, visit DennisPrager.com. Check out some of the great Prager University educational videos at PragerU.com
And while you're there, consider making a donation to support the great work they're doing. And follow Dennis Prager on Twitter at Dennis Prager. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.